this is Scriptlock, where we talk about storytelling in video games. I'm Max Folkman.
And I'm Nick Folkman. Today we have Duncan Fife and John Ingold joining us. Duncan is a writer who's worked on Where the Water Tastes Like Wine, Neocab, and In the Valley of Gods. And he was the co-creator and writer of the Something True podcast. John is a writer and narrative designer and the co-founder of Inkle. He's worked on games including 80 Days, Sorcery, Heaven's Vault, and Over the Alps, which just won the Writers Guild of Great Britain's award for best writing in a video game. So congratulations, John.
Thank you.
And we'll just start with asking, how did the two of you break into the industry? And Duncan, can you go first?
Sure. Well, I was writing for a long time before I ever wrote a video game. And I still don't just write video games, so I kind of think of myself as a writer who sometimes writes video games rather than someone who's all in to the industry. So I'm halfway through the broken window. I started writing online for websites after high school because I wanted to write just anything. And I thought, and this made sense to me at the time, was that I want to be a writer, but and I'm going to go to university, but I'm not going to study creative writing or film or television or English or media or theater or even game development, because I want to learn about like what the whole world is, and I can always write and I can just write anyway. And what can they teach me about writing? Like, I can do writing. So I studied politics and international relations, and like that was not a good thing to do. And I have been paying the price for that decision ever since, because now my career, like on paper, makes no sense. but I started, like at the time that I was doing this, big mistake, I was also writing about video games, which was, I was doing that because I was a fan of a website called Idle Thumbs, which later was a podcast, but was then a website. Which covered video games, and I applied there to write, obviously for free, and did a couple articles for them. And although that went away for a while, I kept publishing my own stuff online, and then eventually branched out into writing articles for like video game magazines and websites professionally, and then more things about non-video game subjects for larger sites. But like the people who I worked with at Idle Thumbs, I stayed in touch with, and many of them were people like Chris Remo and Jake Rodkin and Steve Gaynor, who would go on to be enormously successful in video game development. And I would work with some of them, particularly Jake Rodkin and Sean Vanneman's company, Campo Santo, doing nonfiction stuff for them, like writing articles for their website. But I think when you're writing and all your friends are making video games, you want to at least try and do it. And I did. So it was just a matter of me being very vocal about that being something that I was interested in doing, and having enough of a portfolio of non-interactive writing that game developers could have a sense of what I was like as a writer, enough to be able to tell whether they would be interested in working with me. And those opportunities eventually started to happen. And so here I am.
Was there a piece of writing that you thought was like most applicable to getting into game writing that wasn't game writing when you were trying to get in?
I think this is a rare example, and it's not like I had an interview with a company like the other day who want to work with me as a writer. And the reason why they want to do that is because I interviewed one of the writers years ago, and they were impressed enough with my understanding of the game to feel like, well, if we need a writer, I know this guy who seems to understand like what we do here, which is not what you want to think going into an interview with someone. But that like things like that are helpful. And like, I think I am at the stage where things you did years ago are starting to bear fruit in unexpected ways. I think something I got into the mode of doing was writing stories about real places. Like these are nonfiction stories about real locations in the world that are very strange. And as a reader, you kind of want to inhabit them, if only as a reader of an article, to understand more about how they work and what like the ecosystem is there and how people react to each other. Like one of these is there's this town, Centralia in Pennsylvania, which was a mining town that had like a huge fire underneath it, a mining disaster. Like the town is basically on fire under the ground and 30 years later is still on fire. And now is a ghost town, but is also, was used by the makers of the film adaptation of Silent Hill, as inspiration. And when they cited it as inspiration, Silent Hill fans, even though this has nothing to do with the game franchise, Silent Hill, started kind of flocking to Centralia en masse just for Silent Hill tourism. And the people who still live there and are very bitter about this whole multi-decade battle with the government are very bitter about that, also about people showing up in like a pyramid head costume. And I think when I started to do things like this, it's, you see the potential that is inherent in exploring a very unusual place. Like, I don't know if that's a video game in itself, but finding out about settings and populating them with detail and feeling like you want to explore a place like this and learn more about it was something, or is something, that I think is quite transferable to video games, especially when you're approaching something with from the ground up and figuring out what the setting is and the sort of degrees and avenues that you want to explore. Yeah.
And I want to backtrack a bit earlier to you talking about your university path. Mm-hmm. Why was it a big mistake to not go for like the creative writing or film or English degree and go the way you did? Because that's the path that I wish I took in college.
Or did you mean it was a mistake to go into politics?
Possibly both. But I mean, what I really mean is that it was a mistake to have aspirations of being a writer and then go through university and end it with no connections in any of the fields in which you want to work and no understanding of how they operate. And not necessarily, like, you don't need a writing degree to work in a lot of fields, certainly not video games, which I think is much less gatekept than other forms of writing. But it still helps. Like, and there are circumstances under which it helps to have an MFA in creative writing, which, if that doesn't open doors, I feel like that does a much better job of equipping you to understand where the doors are and what it takes to open them. And I was very naive/misguided in how easy I thought it would be to just sort of like force my way into the world.
Yeah. Okay. And John, how'd you get into the industry?
So I kind of relate to a lot of that, though not all of it. I also kind of, when I was young, I was writing all the time, and I had a similar thought that, you know, I didn't want to go and study creative writing because I could do the writing. The writing was fine. But I remember having this sense that if I just did a creative writing course or an MFA or something like that, then I would just end up writing the same as everybody else. And I didn't want to do that. So I went off and did a maths degree, which was like, I can totally see how a politics or an economics degree, you know, would help with writing and inspire you and kind of give you a direction. A maths degree really didn't help at all, but it has been ridiculously useful anyway through the course of my life. Because I originally started off just wanting to be a normal writer, you know, writing novels and short stories, and I got quite into plays at university, though I don't think I was ever any good at them. But I wrote my first computer game when I was 8 in a notebook before we could actually afford to buy a computer. I got a book on programming from the library and I wrote a computer game program, and I never typed it in, but it was fun to mess around with ideas. I had whole notebooks full of these games that never existed. And then the internet came along, a computer came along, and I found a way of writing text adventure games. So I wrote my first one of those when I was 16. And there was a whole indie development scene back in the 2000s making parser-based text adventures before indie games were cool or even slightly profitable. we invented it. And so I did a lot of stuff with that community. And lots of people who are quite active now came out of that time. So Emily Short was writing at the same time as me. And also Sam Barlow, the guy who did Her Story in Telling Lies this year. They're both kind of alumni from that period. But I was still kind of treating computer games as just this thing I kind of dabbled in that I didn't really take very seriously. I thought, you know, I'm going to be a proper writer. I want to write novels. I want to make a living writing novels. I used to talk to my friends about this idea called interactive fiction, and they'd sort of shrug and say, I don't think that's a thing. And I'd say, well, I don't know. It might be, you know, it might be. And my experience of it was, I think I could never quite work out quite how to write a novel that really worked, or a play that really worked. I had some short stories I liked. I got a few published here and there. But I never quite managed to break through into anything. And then I was a teacher at the time, and then I quit that and I got a job as a computer game designer because I thought it looked sort of interesting. I think a friend of mine talked me into it because I was still having opinions about computer games. And he said, well, why don't you go and actually work for one of these companies? But that wasn't as a writer, that was as a level designer. And I did that for about 5 years. And then I met Joe Humphrey there at Sony. Working for PlayStation, making PlayStation games. And we got talking. So the short of it is that I became a writer for video games by founding my own company in order to write games, because nobody else would publish me or pay me to do it ever in any medium or any format of any kind that I tried. So having failed all the traditional routes, I eventually, founded my own company, and we decided to make games with narrative in, and then I had to hire a writer, and I said, I know just the person! It's me! but I don't really regret that at all. And it's funny, looking back at it now, I think actually it was quite a linear path, really, in that, like, I learned some skills, and I applied them, and then I did the thing I actually wanted to do. And now, as a writer, like, I would love to be writing novels. I would love to be writing plays. I would love that to be a thing that I could do. But I still don't think I understand actually how to do that. They are every kind of writing is a technical skill, and they're all quite specialized. And I don't have a creative writing course, and I've never really analyzed a novel properly down to its guts to understand how it works. I just sort of charged into them. Whereas writing games, I think I understand quite well. So I think I'm in the right place doing the right thing. And obviously having a maths degree really helps with, like, things that are technical. And I'm kind of fascinated by the dance between the words and the writer and the reader and the machine that's orchestrating all of that, and pushing those boundaries of how much you can allow the computer to mess around with the words between the words leaving the author and arriving at the reader. How much can you let the computer get involved without letting it mess it up? Because computers mess everything up eventually. And I really enjoy that. That's a really fun problem to be solving. And it feels like one that's full of moments of real joy and discovery, which I don't think I would ever have had if I was writing novels, because I would only ever have been writing novels that were, you know, maybe better than this person, but not as good as Ursula Le Guin. So, you know, what's the point? Whereas... Yeah, so I don't know. In retrospect, it all makes lots of sense. But at the time, it didn't, and it was a series of very silly ideas that somehow seemed to work out in the end, I think. But I'm only just sort of, you know, I like to think I'm only halfway through this career of being a writer. So maybe it'll all fall apart in a glorious fireball in the end. that would be a suitable arc. Or maybe I'll finally end up writing a novel that doesn't suck. I don't know. But yeah, that's how I got to here anyway.
Like, I can see the mathematics background being really helpful for creating Ankle and programming, but I would also assume that it was good for the nonlinear work and writing branching storylines, because it helps with the logic of it all and keeping everything in check and keeping track of everything.
Yeah, I think there's definitely, it kind of features in a couple of ways, and there's, like, you know, the very specific ways that if I need to set up a system which has some numerical basis to it, I'm not scared of numbers at all. So I can just get on and do it, and sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, but I don't have that sense that I'm out of my comfort zone, because it's fine. And that's very empowering in a technical environment. I think the more interesting thing, though, is that maths is a particular kind of philosophy and a kind of thinking. Once you get beyond number crunching, it's really about problem solving things in multiple directions. and sort of building rules and seeing what they construct and then editing those rules, which is a kind of what game design is really, but it's kind of what story and character design is as well. You put down some things and you see where they get to. But then at the same time, you have an end goal in mind. So you try and dig backwards to find the rules that give you the end goal you want. And that thinking from both levels feels to me like quite a mathematical way of thinking. And my wife has an English lit degree. And she definitely doesn't think that way. She thinks in a slightly different way. And I feel like that kind of particular view of how to put problems together and how to approach solutions for things feels to me like it's useful all the time, partly in the nonlinear environment and keeping track of things, and partly just in figuring out stories anyway, because they're confusing. I suspect it limits me in other ways, but like I've always, yeah, it's definitely not something I ever, ever regret. But then I suppose it was a long time ago, so I don't think about it very much either.
And has your level design work help your writing too?
Oh no, I'm terrible at level design. I always was terrible at level design. I don't really know how I got this job at Sony. I think it was mostly white male privilege, to be honest. And then I very quickly got promoted to managing a small team of level designers because I wasn't actually good at building anything myself, but they were very good at things and I was good at understanding what they told me and like helping them to do their thing better. So I was definitely an incompetent manager during my time there. And I learned a little bit about level design, but I don't have a very good visual eye actually. And the 3D world building, which is kind of the bedrock of level design, was always quite beyond me, to be honest. So I'm not sure that really did help my writing. I think it gave me a sense that computer games were not always the best forum for telling stories because level design is so, it has such arbitrary rules to it. Like, you know, what kind of levels work and what kind of levels don't work for making an experience interesting to walk through or to make sure your camera doesn't clip or any of that sort of stuff, that there's these weird constraints that end up coming all the way through to the story that you want to tell or the world that you want to build or the kind of environments that you can build. But it's very nebulous stuff. And we try to avoid as much level design as possible in our games now, precisely because it's not the problem that we want to solve, really. So I try to ignore it.
John, you've said in interviews that in interactive fiction, some people prefer the blank canvas avatars that can be shaped in any direction, while you feel that or you feel they are too bland and are more like cameras than people. Could you speak to why you prefer well-defined characters and what are your thoughts, Duncan, too?
Yeah, so I feel that very strongly. And I think the reason that I feel it is because of my primary interest when I'm playing any kind of narrative or experience any kind of narrative. For me, a narrative is really about characters. It's about people. We as people are interested in people. And stories and plots and things are really just vehicles for people to do interesting stuff. Because if you don't have a story, people won't do interesting stuff. So you don't really get to see what kind of people they are. But really, for me, people is the core of it and the crux of it and the whole point of it. And if you look at any other medium, if you look at novels and films and stories, there are plenty of novels and films which have an essentially blank protagonist who walks into an interesting world and meets interesting characters. You know, the four children in the Narnia book, in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, are not especially characterized. They're not really strong characters. They're there for children of different ages to project in and say, oh, I'm a bit like this one, so off we go. And it's really about the people that they meet in that world. And that's a perfectly valid way of telling a story and of exploring a world and letting people find their way into a narrative. But the end result is always significantly less complex and interesting than if your protagonist is also an interesting character and we are always in a conversation with that character. So my wife and I have been recently watching through Mad Men, which at least half of Mad Men is unbelievably well written and the other half is not so well written. But the central character there is this fascinating guy. And the whole thing hinges on the fact that he's a fascinating guy who you both like and dislike and who you both empathize with and get annoyed with. And there's a conversation going on between him and the other characters in the world as he does things and they do things, and that's interesting. But there's also a conversation going on between me, the viewer, and him, the character, as I try to understand him and get a better sense of what's going on in his head. And both of those conversations are interesting, and they feed off each other, and they have a tension between the two. So it feels to me like when you make a story with a blank protagonist, it's slightly easier to write. and it's slightly easier for people to just sort of jump into their shoes and be in that world, but you're basically cutting off half of your potential storytelling. You're just leaving it in a box and not bothering to use it. And that seems to me to be a bit of a shame. I mean, if you're going to put several years of work into making a game, then you want to do everything and use everything. So I guess, yeah, for me, like, I don't entirely see the point in a blank protagonist, because a blank protagonist is just a protagonist that you haven't characterized yet, which doesn't mean to say, as people who argue against it would say, oh, you know, but it's up for the player to define what kind of character that character is. And that's fine. There's plenty of scope to give a player involvement with a character without making them a completely blank slate. There are much more interesting ways and nuanced ways to solve that problem and to give people something to do while they're there in your world or in the shoes of this protagonist. And all of those questions of how do you do that are really interesting, and we should totally be doing them, not just saying the simplest solution, which is to say, oh, well, just let's pretend the protagonist is just a cardboard cutout and get on with it. So it feels to me like a prototype. Like, if you have a blank protagonist, it's sort of, yeah, it's a prototype of what storytelling in games can be, but it's never going to be as good as it could be. And I can't really think of any examples to counter that. I can't think of any games where I've preferred having a blank protagonist or thought, yeah, that faceless character really worked to make that narrative more compelling for me. And maybe there are examples, but I don't think I've ever encountered one.
Well, I think it's telling that they've gone from the new Half-Life is not from Gordon Freeman's perspective, and that they're doing it from Alex's.
Yeah. I think that's true. And I think if you look at, I don't know, all the successful narrative games of the last couple of years, they've all been about embodied protagonists, I think. I don't know. You can't draw a trend that widely, I think. And obviously the game type matters a lot. You know, in RPGs, it's harder, so people have blanker protagonists. But yeah, I think I think it'll look quite dated to have a blank protagonist. I think it already does a little bit.
I think there are obviously games that are designed to have blank protagonists or cameras, which I think is a good way to describe that. And these are not games that I write, although if the people who make these games are listening, then I do write them. But like, you know, like a Bethesda game, like an Elder Scrolls or the Fallout games, where those games are kind of about what can I build in this world? And as part of that, it's how can I dress up my camera and what can I make it look like? And then I have some sort of action figure at the end that reflects the hours and effort that I've put into this game to make this character look like this alongside a world, which I've also customized. But I do agree with John. I think it's really hard to control the tone of a story if there's so much of a vacancy in the place where the main character should be, that you have to allow for the game to accommodate any kind of motivation or personality that is at the center. And it's possible, right? Like, this is one of the things that games are actually capable of doing, which is great. Like, you can be reactive to what the player does. But I think there is also a really interesting alchemy that can come out of asking a player to inhabit a character with at least some definition and personality. Like, I think, for instance, a novel is better at conveying an internal narrative than a video game, but I do think there's something interesting about asking a player to perform a role that has boundaries and consider the ways in which they do or do not align with that person as they're going through the game. Like, how would I react knowing Don Draper, for instance? And I don't know what you're talking about with half of it is poorly written. that's insane to me. But like, if you know, like, Don Draper would act like this in this situation, I don't agree with that. I would be nicer to Peggy, for instance, because I like Peggy as a viewer. But is that going to make Sterling Cooper Draper Price like distrustful of Don Draper because I'm breaking with the way he has acted in the past? Like, I think having some element of friction and push and pull is really interesting. Like, I think the earliest example I can remember of that is, I think, one of the early Monkey Island games, where you can you're in some sort of tricky situation, or your like character is super intimidated, and you have the option to say something very brave and flippant. And if you do choose that, your Guybrush, your character, just like completely wimps out and won't say it because he's terrified. And I think things like that are real, like they tell you a lot, and I think are also more interesting, you know, used sparingly or whatever, but they are more interesting moments than if you're just clicking your way through a game and the game is just rolling them with whatever you're doing.
Well, I think for me that like there, some people talk about this kind of idealized dream of a story game where you can do anything and the game will, you know, keep up and respond to everything that you're doing. But I think that actually when you come to play a story game, you want to be guaranteed that you're going to get a story, that you're going to get some conflict and some tension, and that requires some pushback. And, you know, you need to be able to solve the problem of what do you do with the player who's just nice to absolutely everybody and just solves everything. Do they have to just live in this miserable world in which everything always goes wrong anyway, even if you're trying to be the nicest person you can possibly be? Because that ends up actually being a story that I think I don't want to inhabit. Whereas the more sensible approach to me seems to be, the more productive approach, is one in which, well, there are limits on what you can do, and those limits are defined by the physics of the world, but they're also defined by the realities of the character that you're inhabiting. Because it's a game, of course there are going to be limits, and that's fine. And we act within those limits anyway. In the same way that when you play Uncharted, you can't talk to anyone, you can only shoot them. And when you play Outer Wilds, you can't shoot anybody. They're just part of the rules of the game, and that's fine. And your protagonist just gives you some extra rules, but it doesn't mean that you're limited in a meaningless way. You can be limited in a really interesting way. So that seems okay to me. I guess I'm saying that the blank protagonist isn't blank anyway, because they're still giving you choices, whether it's kind of, you know, Renegade or Paragon or whatever it is. Like, they're still limiting your choices for you. They're just limiting them in a really unrealistic way that has no kind of bearing on a real psychological character, which, you know, perhaps is an oversight.
You don't consider yourself a renegade or a paragon?
You know, the last time I walked past a homeless person on the street here in Cambridge, I thought, shall I give that guy a pound coin or shall I kick him in the face? That was pretty much what ran through my... That's not true. That's not what happened.
Duncan... Why did you say, like, why are novels better than internal narratives than games?
I think you can, well, I mean, I think you can spend more time in a psychology with, it's easier when you don't have to ask the audience for their input or give them any control, basically. And I think being able to describe a psychology and sort of take the way a person thinks and try to map that onto a page. So you're reading about events, but you know you're doing it through the prism of a particular character with a distinct point of view and pathologies, and seeing how they react to stimuli and events conveys a lot of information. And like a film has, to a degree, an objective point of view, where I think you, with a novel, with prose, you can immerse yourself entirely in subjectivity, and there's no objective information in there, which, if this is what you want to do, tells you more about personality, I think.
Yeah, totally. A lot of the games the two of you have worked on have required a fair amount of research. Do either of you have any researching tips? Are there resources you go to every time?
Yeah, I think there are two things I do. Like, one thing I do like all the time is kind of ambient research, which is, without trying to extract anything in particular, immersing yourself in the culture of whatever place or time you're trying to represent by reading or watching or listening to things that are preferably of that period or just about it. And that is done to calibrate an internal sense of what feels correct and a representation of those places and times. In addition to that, something I've used, especially for games set in the past, is travel guides of the period. It's incredibly helpful to know, for instance, what, like within the Valley of the Gods, I could tell you what train in 1928 one would take to get from Cairo to Luxor, and how long that would take, and how much it would cost, and what the atmosphere in the train car would be like, and how hot it would be, and what, if anything, you could expect to eat on the train. And the point of, like, I think the point of caring about details like that is not necessarily to create a game that has perfect historical accuracy, but a game and a production that knows what it's talking about and knows that if it's doing something that is not accurate to history, it's intentional and it's for a reason, and you're breaking the rules for a purpose. And I think an audience, especially if they're personally familiar with any element of the fiction, will sense even subliminally if something is off, which damages the audience's trust in the storyteller. As a writer, I think the most important thing you can do is get the audience to believe that you understand the story that you're telling and that you're good enough to tell it. And where research figures into that, I think, like, so I think any work of fiction, especially when it's personal or about people, relies on a balance of verisimilitude and authenticity to feel true. This is something I've been thinking a lot about recently. So like, I could write my memoir, and I think you reading it, assuming you would read it, would be reasonably confident that I know what I'm talking about. But if I'm going to write a fictional story where the main character is, let's say, like a woman, I don't have the lived experience to tell an honest story about what it's like to be a woman, but I can research it enough to mask my own inexperience, I think, by creating verisimilitude. Like, there is no shortage of examples of men writing women very badly, especially in literature. And I think that's actually really helpful. That's a resource. That is something you can learn from and learn what not to do and the specific words not to say. But even if you take real pains to build the details of that character with complete empathy and respect, I think you've still got something that looks okay, but doesn't in itself say anything. Like, an Assassin's Creed game can replicate Egypt or ancient Greece or London very perfectly. But if it's not married to anything, it's just a replica. It's just an illusion. And this is where I think authenticity comes in. Because it's like, what do you know about? What can you speak to from your lived experience, and what can you write about with confidence? And confidence, or a lack of it, is something else that I think an audience can pick up on, like a squid. They sense fear. So, like, I mean, I enjoy researching, and I like the idea that I have a reputation for doing a lot of research. But to me, research is like completely inseparable from writing. Like, you can't do it. You can't write without some understanding of the world. And if it's not your lived experience, you need to research. By which I mean that, like, I invoice for research.
As you should. What about you, John?
Yeah, that's a really good answer. I really like that answer. I agree with so much of that and kind of respect it very deeply. Like, I think a lot of that is very true, and I certainly agree that, in a way, one of the reasons you have to practice writing is because you need to get good enough at actually writing that you don't spend too much of your time on the writing, because actually the writing needs to come quite quickly, really, because once you're writing anything that's reasonably complicated or involved or outside of your lived experience, what you really need to be doing almost all the time is, I don't have a good word for it, the ideation of whatever it is you intend to write. So the getting into your head in a way that, yeah, makes it true and meaningful and worth writing. And some of that is making sure that your characters are realistic or believable or likable or interesting or rich or deep. But a chunk of that is making sure that your world is also all of those things, is plausible and realistic and can function and coherent. And, you know, if it's a real world representation, then it needs to be close enough to reality to work. And if it's a made up one, you know, the world of Heaven's Vault is completely constructed, but it, like, the amount of depth that it has to be constructed to in order just to be plausible when you try to execute anything within that world is pretty high. And so you end up with the kind of research, even if you're doing a completely fictional world, is you just try to put this thing together and understand it and get it into your own head and then finally, hopefully, get to write something about it, you know, which actually comes out the other end of all of this, thinking that you have to do to convince everyone that you know what you're talking about. So I think for me, there's the sort of basics of research. Like, I was thinking when you were saying about the train in Egypt that, yeah, we did do quite a lot of research into transport for 80 days, but there was so much transport, we tried to do it very, very, very quickly. So I spent a little while trying to understand the railway system in America in 1870, which is completely mad. And it seems like every 10 meters of track was owned by someone different. And then you had to buy tickets for each little section. And I got completely lost and I couldn't understand it. So we totally bodged that in the end because it was really unhelpful. But for recently doing Over the Alps, actually, most of the research that I did for writing that, it was a very, very quick writing process. And it's a sort of spy, it's a 1939 spy thriller. And a lot of the research was actually just looking at maps and photographs and methods of transport and trains and how the trains worked and where they went from and where they went to and where the roads were and where the paths were and trying to get a sense of how high the mountains are when you're standing in this valley and what can you see and just the physical world and the maps and things. So I think I'm probably into maps and timetables as my fundamental piece of research, but then I keep writing games about going on buses. So that's kind of come out of that by accident, I think. For me, the other interesting thing is the kind of the line between research and inspiration. So when you're researching things, sometimes you have a question, you say, you know, well, how does a hot air balloon work? And so you go and find out how a hot air balloon works, or how do you steer a hot air balloon, which was a question I'd never considered before writing Over the Alps. And it turns out you don't really. that's fine because you have a question and you know you need the answer and you find out the answer and maybe it informs the way that your story has to go. But then there's all the stuff where you just need to know more about this world, but you don't know where to get it from. And that's kind of my favorite kind of research is rabbit hole research, where I just follow threads or read things that I think might be relevant in some way. So one of my primary sources for Heaven's Vault was a book that I found in a charity shop for 50p, which was a book of popular archaeology written in about 1955. And almost all of the theories in it are wrong or have been disproved, but they're all argued very carefully from the evidence that they had at the time. So you get these really interesting outlandish theories, which are backed up by solid evidence and claims. They're just wrong, which is a really brilliant jumping off point for creating a game with an archaeological bent that isn't set in the real world, because you get some really interesting ideas, which are not in current parlance or not a standard idea that we just accept as being normal. But they're not fanciful and they're not stupid and they are coherent and they come from somewhere and you can see where they're built from. And that book was just a lucky find. And like my bookshelf is just a collection of lucky finds or random things, which kind of just, they aren't really relevant to what I'm writing, but somehow there was something there that spanned my thinking in a way that I found to be useful or resonant or something like that. And I find that to be really important, is just being broad as well, because I think sometimes when you're researching you can get really lost in the specifics of it and then you end up with a big pile of detail that you just have to cram in somewhere to justify it, and actually it's not that great to read. But I don't know, I'm always in awe of people who are really good at researching, because I have quite a hard limit of when I just can't read any more nonfiction. I can't do it. I burn out on research quite quickly, actually. And it's one of the things that was lovely working with Meg Dianth on 80 Days was that she's much, much better at research than me. So her sections of the game are the ones that have quite a lot of intricate detail in them sometimes. And my sections of the game are the ones where Passepartout conveniently doesn't mention anything that he's seeing in the world because he's busy tying his shoelaces and thinking about that. Like, just the particular bit of story that we choose to tell is often one that doesn't really require any knowledge of the outside world. You know, he's got a really itchy coat and it's all about his itchy coat. What's going on in the world doesn't really matter. And that gives us variety and actually it benefits the game as a whole. But it's why I really couldn't have written 80 Days entirely on my own, because I think people would have had this strange sense that they never really entered this world. So I don't know. Research is definitely something I'm getting better at, but I still find it quite tiring, quite hard.
Can I say something about hot air balloons really quickly?
Yes.
Yeah.
So I have been researching hot air balloons coincidentally for something else. And did you know, hot air balloons were so popular in such a fad in the late 19th century or middle 19th century that Percy Shelley, the poet, like wrote lots of poems about how great hot air balloons were. And he thought that the sight of a hot air balloon would abolish slavery, because you would just see this marvelous invention and be awed by it, like the monolith in 2001 or whatever, and just like you'd say, like, what are we doing?
Which presumably the irony of that is the people in the hot air balloon are looking down at the ground and thinking, what are we doing? Oh my god.
What was the most outlandish, one of the most outlandish theories you found in that archaeology book, John?
Oh, no, there's some, that's the thing. They're beautifully, they're not completely crazy. They're sort of highly plausible. But there was, my favorite, I think, was the chapter about Machu Picchu, which argued that it might have been an abandoned village and it might have been a temple complex. But most likely, the people of Peru were experimenting to see if it was possible to have a village that high in the mountains successfully and farm crops. So the emperor at the time built this city and forced a bunch of people to go and live there as a sort of biome type experiment. Like we might turn people into a bubble to see if they can survive on Mars on top of this mountain. They lived there and of course they all died apocalyptically. And I thought that was just such a wonderful theory. Like I'm not sure what the current theory on Machu Picchu is, but I'm sure it's not that, because that's massively over-engineered and really quite enlightenment sort of focused in its tone. But I really liked it. And I think I definitely stole that for 80 days. That just this bizarre idea of just plonking people as an experiment. That's a really bad thing for an emperor to do. It's just wonderfully characterful.
How much are the two of you relying on like the internet or books or talking to real people, God forbid, for your research?
I mean, the internet is the bedrock of it these days. Like, you know, as soon as you get any question, the first thing you do is you go and read Wikipedia about it, because of course you do, because it's right there and it gets you started. For inspirational research, I tend to rely on books, because they're just better for casting your web widely and kind of getting lost in things and disappearing down rabbit holes. I find when I'm on the internet, I have to be focused or I stop paying attention quite quickly.
Yeah, I think a way in which the internet has not made anything, made things easier or created access to more information is that, like, look, when I was doing In the Valley of Gods and was trying to find out things about 1928, this was a period in which people would literally write down everything they knew about Egypt in one book, and that information is impossible to find on the internet outside of a PDF of that book. So I guess it did make it easier in that sense. It got me the book, but the internet discards or decides not to preserve information, I think, quite easily. Like, considering the possibility for storage is infinite, like, things disappear fast, I find. Or like site services get acquired and then pages shut down and things vanish from the internet in a way that it is reassuring to have like a physical resource on hand that you know can just be relied upon.
Yeah, I remember when we were writing 80 Days, Meg had a list of cities that she wanted to include, and one of them was a place called Karamskaya in Russia. So I was trying to put these onto the map and I Googled it to try and find out where the hell it was, and I couldn't find anything on the internet about the existence of this city. Except for one mention of it in one uploaded PDF of a travel document written in 1840 or something of someone describing their trip on the Trans-Siberian Railway. And eventually I kind of phoned her up and I said, where did you get this from? And she was like, oh, I found this really interesting PDF describing a journey on the Trans-Siberian Railway. And I was like, oh yeah, right. Yeah, I found that too. That's it. So we had to kind of infer where this town actually was. But yeah, it genuinely wasn't anything. It had just been completely forgotten.
Duncan, didn't you find something on like secret Lovecraft forum?
Oh yeah. So, well, the book I'm describing, which has all these train times in it, I eventually found more of these. I have like a bunch on my bookshelf right now, but like the holy grail for me was there. Okay. So there is a guy called Karl Baedeker, who is a German travel writer who eventually founded a company, Baedeker, which has a lot of guidebooks for various places around the world. I think it still exists, although he doesn't exist anymore. He's long dead. But and also, the books aren't as good as they used to be. But there was one particular book, which was the like sixth or seventh edition of the Egypt guidebook from 1929, which was very helpful, and you want that for a game that is set in 1928 in a nation where things change very quickly and like understandings of history change very quickly. And literally the only place I could find that, like short of paying $500 for an actual edition on eBay, was for some reason, like there is a Lovecraft enthusiast forum called Yogg-Sothoth, which is a community of people who I guess just like doing their own tabletop modules for Lovecraft games and want like, bless them, they want research and they want to do research and they want resources that will help them, you know, with fleshing out a scenario set in the 1920s. And so someone had scanned this entire 800 page book and uploaded it as a PDF to this website. And the only way I could get it was to apply to the Lovecraft forum, which is a private members forum that I had to pay for, and say, like, there was like an entrance exam where you talk about like why you love Lovecraft and like what's your history with Lovecraft. And so I decided like, oh, I love Call of Cthulhu, which I've never played. And, you know, I really want to get into the community. And then I took that PDF and took a bunch of other PDFs and deleted my account. so that's game development.
Is it possible to research too much?
I think so.
Yeah. Knowing when to stop is quite hard, I think. Like, I tend to stop because my brain falls out of my ears and I can't do it anymore, which is, you know, a useful failsafe. But I think at some point, you're writing fiction. You have to make stuff up, ultimately. You do have to make some stuff up. And research can become this kind of crutch of, oh, I don't know enough. I'm not ready to start yet. I'm not ready to do anything yet. I need to know more. I need to get this right. And actually, ultimately, you don't have that much responsibility to the people that you're representing in the 1920s or the 1870s or whatever. You have some, but you don't have that much. You have some responsibility to yourself to get something written and to your audience to make it interesting. And you have to kind of balance that.
Yeah, I mean, well, at some point, you just have to write something. And I think the reassuring thing about video games is people want you to put content in a game very quickly, at least in my experience. So there's a lot of pressure to not research anymore and get something in the game, which is ultimately a productive impulse.
So is when you stop researching simply because of a deadline?
I think so. But I think there's also a danger in spending too much time in that space, especially if you're not in search of something specific. Or even if you are in search of something specific, I think it can be counterproductive if you're like building parameters for yourself out of historical fidelity that ultimately are not important for what you're doing. If you have an idea and then you find the piece of historical trivia that would mean you can't do your idea because it would be historically inaccurate. Like, I think there's a phase at which you're much more submissive to research and fact. And you really just, like, as John says, like, you need to come up, you can't just read a book and get the idea from it and put that idea in the game. Like, you have to bring something to it.
And it's, you know, it's okay to go off the factual piece. Like, it's fine. You know, at the climax of Over the Alps, the characters get in a hot air balloon and arrive at the destination that they want to arrive at, which is not really how hot air balloons work. you can't do that. And I sort of know that. I read enough about how you steer hot air balloons to realize that knowing more about steering hot air balloons was not going to help me tell my story. So at that point, I had to stop reading about it and just not talk about how he steers his hot air balloon, because that's unhelpful and that's fine. And I don't, you know, there might be an audience member who I'm annoyed with that, but I don't think on the balance of probabilities, I think it was the right decision. And
well, at the end of Over at the Alps, the hot air balloon does not abolish slavery, which is a historical
right, exactly. It's a real letdown.
So you can't steer hot air balloons.
So I may understand this wrong, but what I got was that the way you steer a hot air balloon is that you rely on the fact that the different levels of air in the atmosphere are going in different directions. So what you do is you go up as high as you can and you see which way the wind is blowing. And if it's blowing the right way, then fine. And if it's not blowing the right way, then you spit over the side of the hot air balloon and you watch what happens to your spit. And if you can find a layer of the air that is going the way you want, you lower the balloon, because you can do that, until you're in that layer of air, and then you get blown the way you want to go. And that's how you do it. And if there isn't any wind going the way you want to go, then you land as quickly as you possibly can and you try it again another day. I may have that completely wrong, but that's my understanding based on the research that I did.
Yeah, no, they have a wheel.
To actually steer. But what does it turn? Like, as far as I understand it, they open a flap at the top, which like lets the hot air out so you can go up and down. Because how do you have a rudder? Like, you can't have a rudder. Or there isn't a sail. I mean, is the wheel there just to make you feel better?
No, there's no like, wheel. There's just... no wheel.
Okay. You really genuinely panicked there.
Sorry.
Okay, I'm going to go to a different topic now. It's always interesting to listening to game writers talk about what they appreciate in certain games, because oftentimes it's something that general audiences might not appreciate. So are there any games that do something interesting with their storytelling or just do really well that you think might go unnoticed by most players?
I have a pull for this, which is a Dragon Age DLC from, I guess, 2009, or maybe it's early 2010, called Liliana's Song. Have you guys played that?
I've heard of it. We've heard of it, yeah.
Okay, so here is why I'm talking about this. So it is set before Dragon Age, and you play as one of the characters who is in your party in Dragon Age, Liliana. And it's kind of the origin story for her. And in this DLC, you're playing as her, and you're in your pre-hero life as basically like a member of a gang. And it's controlled by this matriarch figure to whom your character Liliana is fairly subservient. And over the course of the story, Liliana realizes that her mentor has betrayed her and leaves her to die. And then you're playing as Liliana and she's sort of opening her eyes and realizing who her mentor really was and who she herself is. And the game kind of works up to, this is all the beginning, more or less, and then the game is working your way up to a final confrontation with your mentor. And one of the problems with this is that if you have played Dragon Age, which I assume most players of this DLC would have, you know that the mentor character appears in Dragon Age, which means that when Liliana gets to her at the end and defeats her in a boss fight, Liliana can't kill her, and you as a player can't choose what to do with her. Like, you can't choose should she live or die, and that's very much the kind of choice that Dragon Age wants you to make at key moments like this. So it's this problem, like, what are you going to have happen with a game whose ending is kind of already determined and canon? Like, are you just going to watch a very well-executed scene of Liliana deciding to spare her because you know as a player that's what happens? But instead what happens is, at the point where Liliana would kill her or not, it cuts away, and Liliana is explaining in narration that basically whatever she chose to do in that moment doesn't matter, because it could have just as well been either choice. The thing that matters is that she had emancipated herself to be at a point in her life where she could make a choice, which kind of reframes what the whole story is about. It's about that character's epiphany and transformation, and whether or how she takes revenge is not important, because either way, she is independent and capable of choice. And I think there's a lot of ways to look at that, which, like, one of, I don't know if someone would think that is a cop out, but I thought it's a very clever way to deal with a problem of writing something like that. And a really interesting example to talk, to harken back to what we were talking about earlier, where a character can assert a will and an agency that is independent from the player. Like, a character saying, this moment is private to me, and this is what I take from it, and I hope you, the player, find that helpful, but ultimately this is my story. So that is what came to mind when you asked this question. It's not something anyone else can do again, though, I think. I think you can do something like that once.
That's a great example. Yeah, John, do you have one?
I don't have a go-to one, actually. No, I think what I tend to find is when I'm playing games where I'm invested in the story and the characters, that they very rarely, They very rarely embody something in the game that I really like or really respect, but rather they have little moments where I think, oh, that was executed really well, or that particular bit was really tightly done. And the kind of axes that I'm usually excited by are when games manage brevity. Like, film scripts are incredibly brevitous. They're incredibly punchy and to the point, is what I'm trying to say. The number of, in almost all films, the amount of dialogue that people actually say tends to be very, very small. Games suffer from, usually the dialogue is entirely exposition, which is very hard to make interesting. But sometimes you see games that just manage to kind of work around that everything is characterful, everything is interesting, you kind of know what's going on, but it isn't too labored. And like, and there are various ways that people pull that off, and maybe that's from just having like really likable characters. I really enjoyed the Uncharted games, the early ones that Amy Hennig wrote a lot of the scripts for. They were really clever in the way that they use character to get through exposition, and little cinematic things with kind of different scenes going on in parallel and that kind of thing, which you don't even really notice when you're playing because it's just the language of cinema, but it's executed really well. And actually most games don't manage that at all. Most games, they put the camera in the room and have the characters talk to each other, and they go over the same material 3 or 4 times, and we kind of don't listen to it because it just doesn't have any of that pace to it. So I really love it when games manage to get moments of pace, and I try to stop myself whenever I see it and go, oh yeah, no, that's doing it, that's doing the thing, because you can just settle into it and enjoy it too much and you don't even notice that it's happening. God of War was really good at that, but I quite like the AAA. The big AAA kind of family titles are often quite good at it, because I guess they understand what they're doing now. Like, I thought Spider-Man was excellent, actually, just at always delivering stuff that was to the point and getting on with it, which was kind of remarkable, actually. And it wasn't until about halfway through the game when I sort of thought, I'm enjoying this far, far more than I thought I would on a narrative level. And I was really pleasantly surprised by that. And then little other moments. I remember Horizon Zero Dawn having lots of emotional dialogue choices. Well, it didn't even have lots of them. It had like a few, but they were really nicely done. They were really well put in places where you could see that the choice you were going to make, you could see in advance it wasn't going to make any difference. There's like one where her dad goes off and she doesn't want him to go. And there's 3 ways you can shout at him for going. And like, there's a, you know, a needy way and an angry way. And you know that you're not going to be able to change his mind because you're like 10 and he's the dad who's obviously going to die in order to set up the plot. Like, all of that is foregone. So it's really just, how do you feel? How do you want to feel in that moment? And it was just really nicely done. And I made a choice and it executed, and it kind of moved on, and it did that paradigm of a choice that doesn't matter but feels good anyway, which, you know, that kind of caliber of game is always trying to execute and quite often doesn't really know what to do with itself. But I thought that game did a really good job of that. And it's just a tiny little thing, but I really appreciated it at the time. But when I'm kind of looking for examples to really inspire me in terms of what's possible, I quite often fall back on the games from 2000, the text adventure games that people were writing in 2000s, which were super experimental and tried all sorts of crazy things, and no one's ever played, so they're really good to steal from. So, you know,
like, which games
were... Oh god, they all did wonderful things. So there was a game called Ramesses by a guy called Stephen Bond, which had a character who was a shy teenager, and he kept getting choices of dialogue, but he couldn't say any of them because he was too shy or nervous to say them. And he would fight you the whole way until you would be forced to say something crap or do something crap. And then he has this miserable time and everything goes wrong. And you get to a point where he's standing on the edge of a pier and everything's bad, and you just know that this is the story of a teenage boy who commits suicide from being bullied too much. So eventually you summon up the courage, and it's a parser game, and you type, you know, jump off the pier, jump into the water, or jump off the bridge, or whatever it was. And then you get this wonderful sucker punch where he's too scared to do that, and he doesn't do that, and then he walks away and does something else. And it was just a brilliant setup and punch using that restricted input mechanic, but then twisting it on its head to take away my agency at the moment when I thought I knew how this story was supposed to end, and I was kind of rolling my eyes at it, and it was just brilliant. And you see a little bit of that in kind of, I think the last time I saw that mechanic was in Depression Quest, actually, which I guess is quite an old game now, but like, it's been in a few of those kind of early IGF titles as well. And I just thought, oh yeah, no, wait, I saw that 15 years ago and it was good then, it is still good now, and it's just a lovely idea. But we also had like a games with unreliable narrators who you couldn't believe what they were saying, or where they knew more about the plot than you did as a player, and half of it was stumbling around finding out what it was you were supposed to have known in the first place, which I is really bold, but I really like it. And that whole idea of a protagonist with a character and a past that started before the game that you're not being told about, which is a lovely thing to do in text, especially because you can have text with double meanings so easily that you start the game again and you read it again and you realize this thing you read before actually means something else once you understand the construction of the game. The kind of the best example of that was a game by a guy called Andrew Plotkin, who is still very much active in the independent game scene now, though he commentates on games more than he makes them, I think. But he made a game called Spider and Web, which was incredibly famous in that community, which is a spy thriller told in flashback. You're tied in an interrogation chamber and the interrogator is saying, you know, how did you get in and how did you break through the door and how did you do this? And then it flashes back and you play the scene. And if you play it in the wrong way, the interrogator says, no, that can't be right. You know, you said you forced it with a wrench, but we've checked that door. There's no marks on it. You definitely didn't do it that way. Tell me again. And then you start again until you get it the right way. But then in order to actually complete the game, you have to realize independently that the story that you're telling the interrogator is not actually true, that there is a real story, which you have enough clues to be able to figure out what it might have been, which enables you to work out what you need to do in order to escape the chair. And then you spend the rest of the game discovering, kind of executing the end game of the plan that your character, this spy, set up, but without telling you, the player, kind of in free fall. And it, apart from being a genius twist and a wonderful eureka moment, it also gives you that experience of a climax where you can play it out and genuinely feel like a super spy using clues from all the game that you've assimilated so far and executing them. So you're going through a map that you know because you've explored it in incredible detail while setting this thing up, but it's still full of surprises because you don't quite know what's going to happen or what's there and what isn't there. And it just works brilliantly, and it's very, very efficient. It's a very small, tight game, and I've never seen it done. It's a little bit like the twist in Bioshock, but like about a billion times better and like more coherent and more purposeful. And yeah,
the twist in Bioshock is really interesting because I feel like once you do it, you almost can't do anything in the rest of the game that will satisfy the promise of it.
Yeah, it's a nice idea, but it's not really integral to everything. You could have the same game without it, I think.
Yeah, very easily.
Like, it would be fine. Yeah. Which is not to say you shouldn't try it, but it can probably be done better.
Yeah.
What's that game called again?
Spider and Web.
It's called Bioshock.
John, you've said that agency isn't something that interests you in branching narratives as a writer or player. And quoting you, so long as the story is moving forwards and the player's involvement is respected and the story that gets told is interesting, that seems to me to be the goal. So why do you think the industry is still focused around player agency? And Duncan, how do you feel about it as well?
So I should probably foreground that by saying that's a slightly deliberately provocative sentence because it all hinges on exactly what you define agency to be. And I think I made it in a GDC talk where I wanted people to stop thinking about there being a dichotomy between agency and railroading, as if there wasn't a space in the middle, which I firmly believe that there is. I think as an industry, we're focused on agency for not very interesting reasons. Like, if you want to sell someone on a game, we still sell people on features and possibilities and all the things that you can do and, you know, all that sort of thing, customization. And I think agency is a word that people have got in their heads as, oh, this is a measure of how good this game is, how control-y this game is, how much power I get within this game. And there are games which are built on that, I suppose, and there are players who really like that. But I'm pretty sure that if you want to tell an interesting story, you have to have a tension between what the player can do and what the player can't do, and what you can cause to happen in the world and what you can't cause to happen in the world. And that tension, that middle ground, that sense of, I don't know if this is possible, is the whole play. That's the whole thing that we're excited about. That's, you know, that's the will they, won't they of a computer game narrative, is can I or can I not cause this thing to happen? And as soon as we give you agency, as soon as we let you say, this is a thing that you can do, these are the steps you take towards doing it, off you go, that just goes blown out of the water. It doesn't exist anymore. So I think I'm not interested in agency as a goal in and of itself, but I would say that I think it's really important for narrative games to allow the player to come up with a strategy and attempt to execute it, But I think then it's our job as writers, as design narrative designers, to throw the player's strategy off in interesting and entertaining ways. And you can definitely do it badly, and you can definitely frustrate people and make people feel like they're wasting their time. But then, you know, we've all seen plays and films and read books where the plot just kept going wrong and it didn't feel natural. It felt frustrating and annoying and pointless. And, you know, we consider those to be bad books. And I think you can have that in a game as well. The go-to example that I always have for kind of describing this in a way that isn't abstract is in 80 Days, actually. When I was playing through 80 Days and I was testing it towards the end of the day before we released it, and I was taking this the Trans-Siberian Express across Russia, and I wanted to get to, I think I was going to test a bit in Japan. So I wanted to get to Japan to test this bit in Japan. And obviously I knew the routes and I knew the path. And halfway through my experience on the Trans-Siberian Express, I got thrown off the train by a waiter who I'd annoyed. And I was shocked and horrified that I had been thrown off my own train. And I wrote to Meg and said, I just got thrown off the train. And she was like, you wrote that bit. And I was like, did I? Oh, yeah, I did. That's true. Oh, yeah, no, I was a bit of a jerk. So then I was forced to play this other route, despite the fact that I really was genuinely trying to test something. And it was that level of friction was just lovely, because it was annoying and it was frustrating and it did throw me off my stride, but that's a good thing. And it forced me to actually be in that world and respect the people in that world and give them some credence for having some agency of their own. And all of that feels to me like a much more precious and fragile thing than just the business of giving a person using a computer some buttons that do things, because computers are full of buttons that do things. That's not in question. We all have that already. The interesting thing is, how do we make the what's inside the computer feel like it's got some agency? So that conflict between your agency and the computer's agency is way more interesting to me than just giving the player the ability to do stuff. Because anyway, if you give the player the ability to do stuff, they just blow everything up and they like are rude to everybody. We all know that. So I don't see any particular scope in doing that. So that's a slightly unpacked version of what I said.
How about you, Duncan?
Well, I very much agree with John. I think also there's a difference between true agency and expression. And I think allowing for player expression is really important. And like, I've yet to be convinced of a case where that's not important. And by expression, I mean allowing the player to put a stamp on what is happening in ways that don't necessarily have to affect the plot or change the course of the narrative in any way. But like, I mean, this sounds very reductive and stupid, but like letting the player like wear a hat that they want, or like put graffiti on the dumpster that they choose. Like, I think feeling like the game is letting the player customize it in a way, I almost can't think of a game that succeeds without seeming interested in what the player has to say. Like, I've been playing a lot of Sierra games recently, like the old ones with the text parser. And you can tell, like, even those don't really have choices or consequence in the way that we think about them today. And they're actually very linear and only, for the most part, allow for one way of solving puzzles. So you're trying to guess that to get by. But there is this quality that they have where they are interested in a dialogue with the player. Like, you type something and there are certain things you might be able to type that it has a specific response to, or the game is amused that you would even think to type X into the text box and try and do it in the game. And I think that's more important. My completely unsubstantiated theory is that is way more important than letting the player decide what the ending is or what happens to whatever character.
I'm going to add a quick question that is related to what everyone's been saying. John, you talk about the getting thrown off the train in 80 days. When a story doesn't go the way a player intends like that, the tipping point between it being satisfying and frustrating is often very precarious. How do you make sure that stuff like that is satisfying and not frustrating?
I mean, that is so, so hard. That, to my mind, that is one of the fundamental things of interactive writing, is trying to find that balance between things being, like, yeah, but between the game not just giving in and the game not being frustrating and impossible. But the thing about that is that's a pretty good description of game design in general, actually. Like, if you're building a boss for a Star Wars Jedi game, you want to find the gap between it being, like, obviously definitely harder than stuff that's come before, but not so frustratingly impossible that people just put the game down. That's the core job of that scene. It has to feel special, but not too difficult. So I think it's not unusual or surprising that we have to do that as narrative designers. It's just par for the course because it's an interactive environment. We have to give it a bit of scope. We have to give it a bit of wiggle room, and we have to make sure that that wiggle room is as close to good as we can get it. I think, though, that I think the only way you can do that is by writing something, playing it, seeing how it feels and adjusting it and making it better or worse. And sometimes you get it right and sometimes you get it wrong. And, you know, Heaven's Vault is a very big game that's full of bits where people don't really notice that they felt that things went slightly different than expected because they were sort of following a new thread, and full of bits that they love to tell me about how annoying it was and how I did completely the wrong thing and how it was terrible that you weren't allowed to do this or that the robot did that or whatever. And I think sometimes we have a tendency as audiences to overreact to moments in games which are frustrating. And I think that comes from a long history of games being really, really unfair. Like, we sort of expect games to let us down. We expect to find that we have to give up. You know, it goes right back to those old adventure games that Duncan was talking about, where, you know, you could make a mistake and it would lock you out of the game completely and ruin all of your saves and you would have to start from the beginning. And for a long time that was normal, because it's hard for a game to stop that from happening. Actually, they have to do more work to keep you on the rails the whole time. So I think that there's quite a strong trust issue in games. And, you know, the better games and the more polished a game is, the more trust you have from your players. But it's very, very easy to lose that trust and have people just throw their hands up in irritation at the sort of the slightest slight. And there's a huge rage in the audience as well. Like, Enkel games are generally quite good for this, by which I mean quite bad for this, in that they have a tendency to frustrate and annoy the player a lot, deliberately, frequently. 80 Days is built on comic frustration. Heaven's Vault is a dialogue between a protagonist who is not very good with people trying to live in a world with people in it, and that's a lot of its drama. But it goes right back to the Sorcery series, which is constantly tricking you, trapping you, robbing your stuff, breaking your legs. It's always trying to get you into trouble because it is a darkly comic game. But I think a lot of players didn't really realize that it was supposed to be a darkly comic game. Some did, some didn't. And, you know, sometimes people play that game and they find it fine, and sometimes people find it really obnoxious in the way that it always gives you a nice magical item and then steals it from you immediately before you get a chance to use it, which I think is quite funny. But like, some people get really irritated and they save scum really hard to not have this happen to them, and they don't realize that it really, until they finally realize that it is going to happen to them, whatever happens. But for me, that kind of sense of just creating, being able to create games where you can just say to the player, look, you will have things that go wrong, but it doesn't mean that the game is over or that it's gone bad. And trying to produce a gap between the experience of frustration and the experience of something being negative and a downer or a failure. And between failure and being frustrated, because I think there is a gap between those things. We argue about this a lot at Inkle. Joe always gets irritated with me when I talk about trying to make designs which are sufficiently frustrating, because he sort of says, no, frustration is always bad. But it's really just terminology. It's that sense of you need to find a way of presenting your game in a way that it can offer some resistance to the player in an interesting way. It has to, otherwise it's not interesting. It's just charging through a shopping mall, grabbing stuff off the shelves, and that's pointless. It's just tidying up. We have to push back. And so I feel quite bullish about this. I feel like I would rather accidentally frustrate someone who wants to be in control the whole time, because I don't think that's how stories should be done, than make something which kind of is giving in and forgiving the whole time, because I feel like that's taking our teeth out. But not everyone agrees with me. Like, people who disagree, they do like to tell me that. So yeah, I'm very aware of that. But I don't know, I still think it's important.
I think 80 Days to me is a really good example of like caring for failure and not thinking about things in terms of failure. Like the first time I played that game, and probably the first couple of times I played that game, like I did not cross the world in 80 days. But I think the ending to that game, which you get under those circumstances, which I guess you could consider the bad ending, is so there's something so hopeful about it, about the idea of trying again, that like is inspiring. And I think that goes to that speaks a lot to how you like whether you think about good innings versus bad innings and fail states. I think it speaks to how carefully you craft failure and whether you want to imbue it with any sort of narrative potency, as opposed to just making it just like, well, you're fucked up.
Yeah. I mean, I think like in 80 days, it's a core part of it for me, because it's a game which is all about getting around the world in 80 days for this bet and slowly realizing that the bet doesn't matter. The 80 days limit doesn't matter. And either you enjoy the journey or you don't. That's literally what the narrative is about. And so, but we do get players who hit that 80 day mark and then reset. They throw everything away and they go back to the beginning because they can't accept that, the terms of that. They can't accept the terms that this is a journey. They have to try and succeed to beat the thing that they've been told to beat. And I mean, if they enjoy the game, then great, they enjoy the game. But I don't think they're playing it the way that the game is. I think they're playing a different game than the one that we made, because I think that doesn't make sense to me. It's definitely optimized for one type of player and not both types of player, and that's just how it has to be.
There's also an ending in 80 days where you can die in the Arctic or the North Pole. And I think you can't, is there one other situation in which you can die in the game? But
no, that's the only one.
That's the only one. But I think like that ending has so much just dramatic power as a piece of writing that I think even though it's like very unambiguously, you got to start over, like you didn't do it. Like I am so happy that I got to experience failing in that game in that way, because it sticks with you. And I think like another example of that is the quote unquote bad ending in The Witcher 3, which is like a really dour, depressing ending, but it feels, and it also is very predicated on you made the wrong choices at key moments, which is kind of a frustrating set of circumstances under which to end up in that ending. But it's so dramatically well executed that it feels of a piece with the rest of the game. It's kind of much more powerful than the endings in which the player gets everything that they want.
I mean, Joe often talks about the ending of Heavy Rain that he got. If you remember in Heavy Rain, there were four protagonists and it was possible for all of them to die. And Joe had the playthrough where they all died. Like, the game carried on and it gave him an ending. And he was like, yeah, you're trying to tell me that this isn't a failure, but it really feels like a failure. I thought, yeah, no, I mean, that's quite ambitious to make a narrative which ends, you know, hopefully and wholesomely with the premature death of all of your characters. That was perhaps biting off more than even the great David Cage could chew.
So each episode we have our guests ask a question to our next episode's guests. In our last episode, Mary Kenny asked, what is the role of writers in early and pre-production to you? And connected to that, writing such an upstream department in that we're affecting everyone else anytime we change anything. So how do you mitigate that? How do you work within that? Do you have any tips or tricks for surviving the rewriting process while all the other teams are watching you going, why?
Yeah. For me, the only way to solve that problem is to run a company in which you are the most important person in the room, or one of the most important people in the room, in which pretty much everyone has to do what you tell them to all the time. And you have eyeballs on absolutely everything that's going on. And I don't know how else to solve that problem.
That's a good answer, though.
It's cheating, but it does seem to work for us.
I don't have a lot of experience with this, so I will answer it. I think you want like writers engaged with everything, or at least that's how I like to work. Like, I don't really want to write on a game without understanding how all the pieces are working together, if only because that helps you understand the language of what you can do. And I think you want to know that changing something will mean that another person has to do X to compensate. And there are times when you're going to want to fight for that and times when it's not worth picking that battle. But like, why is Mary is much more successful and experienced than me. So I don't know what she hopes to get out of that.
Out of the rank test question applies because John runs his own company. He doesn't need to do rank tests anymore. So what's a storytelling related question you'd like to our next guest to answer?
One thing that bothers me a lot, how do you know when to stop? Because you can always pile more content into something and you can always tweak it and you can always redraft it. So how can you tell when you need to just stop?
I wonder that every day. Duncan, do you have one?
Yeah, do you guys know Pyst?
No.
It's P-Y-S-T. It's the parody of Myst.
No.
John, do you know Pyst?
I don't, but that's a great question.
Well, that's not the question. My question is, so there was, if like this was a commercial video game that was released on the heels of Myst. It was called Pyst. My question is, if you had to write a parody game of a video game that is a parody of another video game, what would it be a parody of, and would you write it under your own name?
That's a good one. We would never come up with that question. That's and a great question. That's it for today. Where could people find you two on the internet, like Twitter or websites or anything?
I have a website. It's duncanfife.net, and I'm on Twitter at duncanfife.
Great.
And I'm at John Ingold and at Ingle Studios, and we're inglestudios.com.
Great. And you can find this Twitter, the podcast Twitter, at ScriptLockCast. And our music was done by Isabel Ness and logo done by Lily Nishida. And that's it. Thank you both for coming on. This is so good.
Thank you.
You're welcome.